All right, welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I am back. Thank God for you listeners. I'm sure you are absolutely in jubilation knowing that Bissett's back and we can actually talk some sports sense and not have Flynn and Jim rattle off, previous wrestling, WrestleMania bouts and bodybuilding and heavy talk about paedophiles. Why is it every time I leave this podcast, the conversation gets pivots, paedophiles?
Well, we wanted to keep an element of your personality on the pod in your absence. So that's the reason why. But now I know for a fact that you have listened to the podcast that we did in your absence. And I think it was about an hour and 40 minutes of pure trolling for you. We were laughing our heads off thinking, we can't wait for Bissett to come and listen to this. And you only got round to it the other day, didn't you? And your response was classic, a one word review, which I thought summed it up nicely.
Yeah, and I'll leave that up to the imagination of the listeners to what that one word was. But I'll tell you what though, mate, honestly, you did a fantastic job doing that part on your own. I thought it come across really, really well, man. So kudos to you for doing that.
Thank you very much, man. And you can tell that I'm used to doing it on my own because I've just spoken over you, which makes the edits absolutely impossible. So you can enjoy that later on. But yeah, I did struggle a little bit with the tone, etc. And anyone who listened to it, I hope it wasn't too much of a chore. It was different, let's put it that way. And I'm very glad to have you back. And in your return, we're losing Flynn as well for a second week running. He's got his trip to England. And he was very, very evasive as to the causes or the reasons behind that trip.
Secret escapes.
Secret escapes. I've got a disciple in my midst. So Flynn, whatever you're doing, I hope you're having fun, Mark. I hope it's not too choresome, though I have a feeling it might not be. So we're back to a two-man crew, but with the possibility of a third later on.
Yeah, we're going to have Tommy Howes on, our NFL expert, we could say. He's going to come on and talk to us about the draft and what's been happening in terms of trade. So hopefully we're going to have him on in around about an hour. But me and Jim are going to get started with the Football League roundup, which we haven't really talked much about the Football League. So there's been a lot of promotion relegation in the last couple of weeks that we need to speak about. We have, the sort of weekend's Premier League results that we're going to gloss over because we want to spend a lot of time talking about those two Champions League semi-finals that have happened this week. So two huge games, one that almost had a massive surprise and one that had a really, really big surprise last night. The Champions League never fails to disappoint. So we're going to go over that. And then in the featured fights, not the combat sports, as Jim called it last week. We are going to talk about that historic bout between Katie Taylor and Amanda Serrano, which, it has to be said, has well and truly transcended the women's game. And we're also going to review Shakur Stevenson's unification of the junior lightweight division. So a lot to talk about today. So we're going to get off the after preamble ramble with a player that has been kind of a budding sort of favourite, one of the favourites really of this podcast. And somebody that perhaps doesn't get as much attention as he should, and that's Son Heung-min. And when are we seriously going to talk about him being one of the best players in the world right now and potentially one of the best players in the Premier League over the past, three or four seasons? He's now got 127 goals and 73 assists in 321 games for Spurs. And that's has not been as a central striker. A lot of time he plays out wide. A lot of the time he plays as sort of more of a support player rather than the man that, Tottenham are building around, because obviously they've got Harry Kane there that's been scoring a lot of goals. And we know how good their relationship's been over the past in terms of like their assists. I think Flynn said last week that they have the most the highest goals assist partnership out of all time in the Premier League. But he will most probably eclipse the 100 goal mark in the Premier League next season. I think he's on 87 now. So it's easy to say, what is he? I think he's 30 now, 30, 31. So if he stays there for another couple of seasons, he'll eclipse that and he'll join that elite 33 players that have achieved that. Has there ever been such a well-rounded team goal threat? Does that make sense? Yeah. A well-rounded team goal threat as Son Heung-min over the past few seasons.
When I read this in the script, I was struggling to think from, the surface level of football players that I usually draw from in terms of questions like this. And you're actually talking about the big boys, aren't you? You're actually talking about like Ronnie, Benzema. Do you know what I mean? Bale, when he was like firing on all cylinders. Going back like 5 years or so, within that kind of span, you're actually looking at the 80, 100 million pound players with those kind of contributions, notwithstanding the man, as you say, he's formed an excellent relationship with Harry Kane. That's been mutually beneficial for them too. So he's up there. I mean, who could you say has been more effective within their team, both as a goal threat? Because, I mean, did you see his goal the other day against Leicester? That left-footed finish into the ridiculous top corner. Left Kasper Schmeichel, who's an outstanding keeper, just like no chance, absolutely took him out of the game. No deflection, no nothing, just FIFA, R1. If you could think of another, do you think of any examples in terms of goal threat and assist and industriousness as well?
That's what it is as well. It's not just his goal scoring. Like Harry Kane with, you know, he's not far off in terms of like, right, he provides the team as well. But as you said, like that goal he scored the other day, that's kind of cemented where he is right now in terms of like being an elite level footballer. And even his first goal, really good sort of striker movements. You know, he's sort of like, he had to adjust because it wasn't going to go on one foot. And then he's managed to sort of like have the composure to like slide it in the corner. Right. It's one of those sort of like miss hit goals sometimes where it works out better for you when you don't hit the ball cleanly. But he's getting into the right positions. He's assisting his teammates. He's scoring absolute bangers, as you've just alluded to, like R1 finesse finishes with his left foot. Honestly, really, really good player. And for me, he should be in the conversation of being the PFA Player of the Year this year. De Bruyne has won it last 2 years. It will certainly be the front runner to make a hat-trick. He's had another very good season, should Man City win it. And then obviously, you've got Mo Salah. You know, he hasn't been as sort of prolific and he hasn't had that purple patch over the last few weeks. But I think he had a stage this season, I think prior to him going to African Cup of Nations, where he was like shit hot. And like he's been consistently good for a long time now. Or a sort of surprise one, maybe Thiago Alcantara. You know, we speak to Ben Pritchard a lot on the WhatsApp group, and he's a big Liverpool fan. And, you know, I was alluding to how good he's been. I think it was the final against Man City where he was fantastic. And I think his performances have been to that level consistently. I said to Ben, is that the best performance he's had in a Liverpool shirt? And he was like, to be honest, he's been like that every week. I think he should be in the conversation as well. But what about you? Where would your vote lean?
Well, you've put yourself there. Mo Salah, obvious candidate. But I was just going to, I'll rewind a little bit to a question I was going to ask you. And it's an unfortunate observation, if you like, that the player who is attached to the team that has experienced the most success is going to have a few more points shuffled in their direction. And I wouldn't want Son to suffer because Tottenham may or may not finish in the top four. You know, there's definitely that connection that you draw. You know, you think about World Players of the Year, European Players of the Year. Almost reflexively, you look to the trophies they've won.
Regardless of Jorginho, wasn't it? For the Ballon d'Or. Yeah. And there was a lot of talk about him being a good candidate for the Ballon d'Or because he'd won that Champions League and the European Championship double with Italy. But obviously, it didn't end up that he won it. But I think that's a great point. I think players usually do get these awards based on their club's achievement. But if you look at, you know, Son's goals contribution for Spurs, I think it's like 43%. It's nearly basically every other goal Spurs score, he's involved in, either directly by putting it in the back of the net or his assisting. That is an incredible stat, man. I don't think there's many players in world football that could boast that right now.
And it's not as if Spurs, all right, they might not be winning the Premier League or whatever, but it's not as if they're a rubbish team. They've only recently experienced like a miniature slump in probably a three-month run of absolutely smashing it. You know, they had a really lukewarm start to the season. Questions about Kante. They've had that tumultuous managerial situation over the past few years. A lot of instability there. And, you know, they've absolutely... There was even that interview where Kante was like, yeah, they should be asking questions of me, which had everyone else thinking, is he on his way out the door? Are PSG going to be looking for him? Kind of thing. And they've just turned into a completely different team. And obviously, Son's a massive part of that. I can't think of another player who would even come close to those stats. I mean, I'm not even privy to that information. But in terms of effectiveness, you're looking at like Ronaldo at Man United, basically, aren't you? Like surrounded by idiots and like pulling out goals every other week. It's one of those kind of situations. Not saying like Tottenham are like a shambles as much as I was consider Man United, but I would say Son's contribution is definitely on par.
Yeah, and I was just going to get up what his goal contribution was, because he was the only name that was sticking out in my mind as being like a front runner for... All right, yeah, so Ronaldo's is 42% goal participation. So it's very, very close. I think it's in the same sort of region, 46%. So slightly higher than Ronaldo's. But and then just as a comparison, Salah is... You can imagine Salah's been a bit less just because there's other players in that Liverpool front three that are going to spread the goals and spread the assists in it. So Salah's was 41%. So that's what you're looking at, man. You're looking at the key players in the Premier League right now that are up there in terms of the goals and assists. Salah, obviously 22 goals and 13 assists in 32 appearances. Huge numbers, but still only 41%. I say only, but less than Son's 46%. So in terms of how important he is for Spurs, that surely should make a difference when you're coming to assessing, you know, which players are going to get the vote in terms of being the player of the year. So I'd like to see him get the PFA player of the year. But we'll move it into the Champions League semi-finals, because we're going to go over these at least for 20 minutes, you'd assume. Liverpool basically looked like they were through, didn't they? And I know when I was listening to you on the podcast last week, you were sort of like giving Villarreal a little bit of hope. And I was thinking, what are you on about, Jim? Like, they got no hope. Like, Liverpool are 2-0 up from the first leg. Villarreal, they're probably going to, you know, try and win the game in the first half. They're going to get undone by Liverpool, because Liverpool are going to be too good for them defensively. Then they're going to hit them on the counter-attack, and it could end up being 4-0 Liverpool. But this semi threatened to turn into a fully erected lob on by halftime, man, because Villarreal absolutely shocked the Merseyside juggernauts into a 2-0 lead. The goals came from Boulaye Dia after some bustle from an ex-Spurs man, Etienne Capoue, and then former Arsenal man, Francois Coquelin, looked to set up a North London nightmare for Liverpool. The referee blew his halftime whistle, but ultimately, you know, it ended in disappointment. And it was a little bit of disappointment, because at halftime, there was so much excitement about the game. And I was like, it was perfectly poised, wasn't it? And then, you know, like a bird in the club letting you buy her drinks all night to then tell you she has a boyfriend that you should fuck off home. Like, that's what happened then, ultimately. So what did you make of this?
Yeah, the lesson from that is just let him sleep with you. You know, don't let him buy you drinks. Obviously joking, ladies. No objectification here on the Ball Chats podcast. But as for the game itself, you know, I watched the highlights the next day, as I often do, and I was surprised at how aggressive Villarreal seemed to be playing. Their first goal was beautiful. Like, that quick cutback, that's easy to say three times, isn't it? That quick cutback, there was no saving that. Like, I can't remember. Oh, Capoue must have received the ball. He was literally one touch back across the 6-yard box, slam into the net.
Personally, beautiful. Reckon it was a miss hit, to be honest. But
do you think, yeah?
Yeah, I think it probably was a miss hit, but we'll give him. We'll give him.
Well, yeah, you know, I was going to say you don't shoot, you don't score, but the metaphor isn't apt here. But for me, I thought it was well worked. But for the second, I was aghast seeing Coquelin sailing above our boy Trent at the back post to guide in the header. As you say, it looked like a tent pitch in time for everyone except Liverpool fans. I can't quite register, and I must hold Trent in really high regard, because I was genuinely surprised to see that happening. Seeing him caught out of position, seeing him out jumped, seeing him just outmaneuvered, you don't see that very often. So I just thought, especially like Coquelin, like a defensive midfielder, not that physically strong, he to me indicated the level of aggression that Unai Emery had tried to impose upon his team. But even 2-0 down, you would have struggled to imagine Liverpool not mounting some kind of a fight back. And they definitely did. But they might not have been so successful had it not been for the wide open legs and empty skull of Villarreal keeper Geronimo Rulli. He would have slotted right in to Arsenal's 2010 squad. No problem. Move aside Manuel Almunia, Lucas Fabianski and Roy Czechesny, because there's a new man who can let in three goals in the last 5 minutes of an absolutely crucial tie. He was definitely at fault for the first, really. Fabinho's shot was from an unlikely angle and he just skipped through his legs. I think he can be forgiven for the second. Luis Diaz beat the offside trap and headed the ball at his feet. There was an element of it unexpected, kind of people freeze in that moment, don't they, when somebody beats the offside trap that quickly. And it was a bit of an awkward one. I get it. And then Trent as well, him erasing that early mistake with that assist, which I've noticed a lot of teams doing. I don't know how long it's been going on, but you know that cross from kind of the three-quarter depth, it's not parallel to the penalty box, but it's kind of a straight line from the corner. That deep cross causes so many problems. But you see that in the Real Madrid game as well, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But Trent, obviously, he could ping the ball anywhere he likes, and he definitely smashed it there. That wasn't like top-level keeping from Rooney, but I don't think it was a gaffe either. But that can't be said for the third goal. Bissett, maybe you can enlighten me. What was he doing all the way out there trying to tackle Mane? Like, he's a defensive midfielder. He was basically on the halfway line. Like, what was going on?
It was balls to the wall for Villarreal, wasn't it? They were, 2-2 at that point, was it? Was that the third goal? Yeah, so they basically, yep, they had to high-press Liverpool. I think every single Villarreal player was in the Liverpool half. Mane actually started his run in his own half. So that shows you how high the defensive line was for Villarreal. So he was playing sweeper keeper. He probably started on the edge of his box and thought he could get there, innit? So he thought he was Manuel Neuer, but clearly not. And with a name like Geronimo, fucking hell. That's how he looked, man. Like, he should have got there. But if he would have stood off, then Mane would have had probably a one-on-one with him anyway. So he had to go, but it was just a bit comical, really, wasn't it? And to be honest, I was slagging off Jason Koundé on TalkSport massively for the way he was really disrespecting Villarreal in the first leg. He was saying stuff like, it was like Liverpool in that first leg were playing a team that were bottom of the group stage. And he was saying that, like, they shouldn't be there. They don't deserve to be there. It's embarrassing for UEFA that they made it to a semi-final. I was like, mate, they beat Bayern Munich and Juventus over two legs. Shut the fuck up, man. I was like, how can you even say that? That's so disrespectful to Villarreal and Unai Emery and all their fans and all the players. So I was really pissed off with that. But he did get it right about Geronimo Rulli. He clearly doesn't look like an elite level goalkeeper. But the thing is with Villarreal, like, they haven't got elite level players. Like, they've got there by, you know, working hard, playing pragmatic football. What did he expect? What did Jason Koundé expect Villarreal to do in the first leg? Go out there and high press them and get absolutely torn apart. Like, no, they tried to play pragmatic. They tried to get behind the ball, play sensible, be in with a shout in the second leg. And they were. And then in the first half, you know, everything fell their way. Liverpool was probably the most shook I've seen Liverpool in about 18 months. Like, nothing was coming off for them. The passes weren't connecting. All those beautiful long-range passes and you know, the connecting passes that they usually play just weren't coming off. They made mistakes, you know. So they did it right. They did the tie. I think they got the tie right, and Unai Emery got it right for 75% of the tie as a whole of the two legs. It was just unfortunate that you're playing the best team in the world right now, and they can bring players on like Luis Diaz, who's been an absolute find, by the way, to completely change the game. And ultimately, that's what happened. And the quality it shown in the end. So I don't know what he could have done differently at halftime. You know, if your team, you know, goes into that half, like, you're all squaring the tie, you don't change anything, do you? You just say to your players, look, that is a fantastic first half. Go out there and just repeat what you just did. That's probably what you say, isn't it? You probably don't make any tactical adjustments. You're not going to take a player off and go and put another defensive player on, are you? So what does he do in that situation? You've just got to go out there, do exactly the same thing. But just unfortunately for Villarreal, you're playing against the best team in the world, and you just came undone ultimately. So,
well, it's like you say, like, the quality of Liverpool is such that they didn't even have to. That sounds like as if, oh, they can play at 50%, but they'll still smash it. That's not really what happened, is it? It's Liverpool weren't at their best, and they managed to drag a result out in a pivotal moment of their season. And if you take away Geronimo Rulli's mistakes, they might not have got through. You know, sometimes the finest of margins separate teams. I remember the 2006 final, Arsenal against Barcelona. And I think it was the winning goal. Was it Belletti who scored, the right back? Arsenal were 10 men for the whole game, still went 1-0 up from a Sol Campbell header. And the goal that he scored, Belletti, was quite similar to the one that Fabinho scored against Rulli. Really wide angle, quite tight, smashed it through his legs. I feel like I'm being harsh towards him, but it just so happens that it was his mistakes magnified that made the distinction between the two teams. I think that's a tremendous result for Liverpool. A praiseworthy performance, really. And I just hope they're at their best for the final because, as you say, for the last 18 months or so, Liverpool have been scary, really.
Yeah, and that brings us into the second semi-final, which unfortunately I missed because I was out coaching. But looking back at the highlights and, you know, seeing the result, you know, I basically saw the result when it came back, checked it, initially saw the 3-1 and thought, oh, well, you know, that's it. Man City have been beaten by the better team on the night. But when I checked the timing of the goals and then I've watched the highlights back, I agree with Joe Barr, what he said on the chat, man. I felt gutted watching it back for Man City because it looked like they controlled a lot of the game. You know, they went 1-0 up, I think, was it the 70-something minute with Mahrez? Another goal for him.
Mad goal as well. Like, the layoff to him was trickling across the box and his finish was so composed, almost defiant. Like, this is going in. Such a sweet curl on the ball. Power. And it was immense. And I think he came off the bench as well, which is not the first time Pep has done this late season. And obviously, I'm not going to question his tactics or whatever, but you wonder what kind of impact he could have had from the beginning.
And I think I remember us going through his, you know, where he started and where he scored his goals. And I think he started more Champions League games than Premier League games. I think it was like 50% start rate or something in the Premier League, but he started all the Champions League games. So there is that kind of, all right, the question about Guardiola overthinking things again. And I know there was a sort of theory doing the rounds on Twitter, as they do, about Guardiola watching Ancelotti's pre-match conference on like a sort of a pitch side monitor just before the game. And him like having his head in his hands as if he's like heard something that Ancelotti said that that tactically he might have like forgot about. And people were saying, I wonder if he's overthinking things again. But it ultimately came down to the fact that I think for the 90 minutes, Man City were a much better team. Real Madrid didn't score their goals until what, the 90th and 91st minute, literally back to back. And they were their first two shots on target in the game. So it shows you how well Man City did of nullifying Real Madrid. And then, you know, it's just one of those. I just think it's one of those where, like, you switch off for a minute against quality opposition. That can happen. I don't think Man City would have played that game any differently. You know, they missed, like, I think Grealish had two huge chances in the sort of, like, last 5 minutes. He had one that was cleared off the line by, I think, Mendy. And then he had one that just trickled past the post. And, you know, it could have been so easy if one of those, you know, you're talking yards, man, centimetres in this game. And at the elite level, that's what matters, isn't it? So you are literally centimetres away from being absolutely solidified in the final. But ultimately, you switch off and the best teams in the world are going to do that to you.
You know, I'll say this for that second Jack Grealish chance where Grealish was looking like Primo Villa Grealish in terms of how long he holds onto the ball, turn the defender, then he's across, shooting across the goal. That was a save from Courtois, like literally the tip of his boot. You couldn't make any less contact with the ball and still redirect its trajectory. And Courtois, I think, has been relatively poor over the two ties. But I'll say this, that I didn't get that impression from watching the highlights that Man City dominated the game. I haven't looked at the stats or anything like that. And again, highlights can be misleading in their own way. To me, in the first half especially, it looked like Real Madrid had more chances. I know Benzema came close. Vinicius Jr. came close as well. And Modric just looked like he was spraying the ball all over the pitch at will. But I suppose that's nothing new to Real Madrid fans and even old-school Tottenham fans. But yeah, I didn't get the impression that Man City were done in it. In fact, Riyad Mahrez's goal, when it came, I thought, oh, they've done well to turn around the tide of the game there. But again, I'd have to watch the full 90 minutes to get a full perspective on it.
Yeah, and I haven't seen the XG stats. Obviously, we were massive. We condone the XG stats on here because it shows you about the quality of chances that were created, because obviously Real Madrid didn't test the keeper until the 90th minute. But the chances, or the quality of the chances that they created, probably warranted that they did. I know the you're on about the Benzema header, aren't you? That just, he just got slightly under the ball and it went over the bar. And then you got the Vinicius chance where it was kind of like on the half volley. He sort of chested it up and it didn't fall for him. And the volley, I think it was left footed volley, went over the bar. But as you say, I think Thibaut Courtois, I think, yeah, he hasn't really been considered like one of the best goalkeepers in the world over the last few years, but I've heard a lot of people say about how good he was overall in that second leg, and how good his distribution was. And perhaps on the other side, Edison, who a player that we definitely considered one of the best ball distributing goalkeepers in the world. He made some, you know, I think he's probably at error for the first goal, the equaliser, where, you know, I think the ball was put back down into the sort of near the 6-yard box, and he was a bit slow to react. And I think, who was it that got the first? Was it Rodrigo that got both? And he sort of like nipped ahead of him and was managed to poke it in. So maybe he's at fault for that one.
Mate, you know, for that goal, I think again, Benzema broke through, steered the ball back with his left, and Rodrigo got in front of him. I think in that situation, you're almost taking the keeper out of the equation, which makes it such an effective attack. Like, what is the keeper supposed to do there? I mean, one example of Courtois of his indecisiveness is Jack Grealish's first chance, where he didn't know whether to come or go, whether to dive, and he ended up just sitting down in like a weird, like a kind of Jean-Claude Van Damme split stance. And Steve McManaman was on the commentary going, what is he doing there? Like, what is going on? I think then Mendy got back and cleared it off the line. And I think in the first leg, that Bernardo Silva goal, I think, like, that is within reach there. You know, I think he got distracted by what the referee was doing. And even with Riyad Mahrez's goal in this tie,
could have done better with it near post, didn't it? Like, whenever you get beat by the near post, you always question the goalkeeper.
Yeah, but you could see that he was reading it to go to the far post, and you could see he'd adjusted his feet to go that way. And then by the time the ball was about 2 feet away from him, it's like an ah, fuck kind of moment, and he's readjusting. But by then, the ball was already past him. So it's I do think his judgment, he's made a few incorrect judgment calls, but we're talking about half a second here, and that's top level sport. So I'm trying not to be too harsh on him, but he did stand out for me as a bit of a liability for Real Madrid.
Yeah, and it shows at what level we're assessing the different goalkeepers, because you've got Rulli where we're assessing him on a completely different level, aren't we, to Thibaut Courtois, whereas we're talking about the minuscule, the minutiae of, like, you know, slight different technical deficiencies were there. So it just shows you the different levels the goalkeepers were on. And just a quick word about the referee. So I know there was some chat in our group chat, which I was like going back over. And there were suggestions that the referee, I think it was at the end of extra time, only played 3 minutes when there was Militao, I think it was, that was down injured for 5 at least. So I think there was a suggestion that they didn't play enough stoppage time. And then the referee definitely blew early. He definitely blew at least 10 seconds early before the 3 minutes. Is that just like maybe, you know, English football fans or the guys that want to see the two teams, English teams in the final? Is that us just having a little bit of sour grapes, or do you think there's some ground in there that maybe the officials didn't quite get that right?
Well, again, I couldn't really comment on the extra time, added time situation, but I definitely thought the foul on Benzema for the penalty, which he went on and scored, I didn't think there was anything in that.
Mm. See, and I disagree with that. I've only looked back at it once, but I'd argue that I think that is a penalty.
The reason I say it's not is because it's as if their body shapes, the defender and Benzema's, were both perfect for it to appear like a foul. But there is, I don't know if there's any contact. I really don't know. If there's any, it's from like the rear foot. And Benzema's body shape indicates he's been absolutely clattered. Now, I'm not really cussing him for diving. There is an element of that in any challenge that goes on in the box, especially in the last 5 years or so. It is part of the game. And I don't really think it shouldn't be a part of the game. I think you should play to win, and that's that. But when you've got so much VAR technology at your disposal, I honestly don't think that was a penalty. But by the same token, I'm not really bothered about seeing two English teams in the final. I was just as happy to see Real Madrid turn it around. If anything, I would rather have seen Real Madrid go through, because we've seen Liverpool versus Man City so many times. Their rivalry is going on in the league. It happened in the FA Cup the other week. They've played. We've seen that play out. And I know the stakes are going to be higher, but for me, it's a bit more exotic watching Liverpool versus Real Madrid, especially when Real Madrid have been able to turn things around the way they have against Man City.
And then you've got that revenge, the revenge mentality as well, haven't you? From the final, was it 2018, I want to say, where Bale scored that, like, one of the most iconic Champions League goals you're ever going to see. Like, unbelievable. Unreal. And then obviously you had the Lloris Karius, who made the two howlers as well, that basically ended his career. I think he's like playing in like the second tier of German football now because of that. Like, literally because of that. I think he'd probably still be Liverpool goalkeeper if it wasn't for those two gaffes. But I've just watched that penalty again. Now, it's a penalty all day for me. Ball comes back into the area. Benzema takes a first touch. That was really perfect. He, you know, had the contact not come, I think he was going to get on the end of it and probably take a shot. And the referee gave it initially. So I think that makes a big difference. When the referee gives it in real time, the general consensus is unless the player's got the ball, unless he's clearly got a part of the ball, it's very, very difficult to overturn because the referee gave it in the first instance. So,
See, that's interesting because I don't think the defender got a part of the ball. My argument is that he didn't make enough contact, but that argument of not making enough contact is kind of null and void in the modern game. So, yeah, from that perspective, I agree with you. And to be fair, I could watch it again in 10 minutes time and reassess like what I think about it. So I'm not like really hung up on it, but my initial idea of that situation was that it wasn't really a foul. But to be honest with you, you can't say anything more about Benzema scoring two penalties, both legs. I thought he was going to go for a second Panenka. That's the kind of level this kid's on. And did you see how close to the post his penalty was? You couldn't have got that more in the corner of the side netting. Perfect. Big Karim. Mate,
the geezer is in what's his name? Csikszentmihalyi, a sports psychologist or whatever he is, what he would call flow. He is in flow, man. He's in the zone. Like, he's playing elite level football to the best of his ability. And, you know, everybody will be talking about him getting the Ballon d'Or now, I think, after his performances in these Champions League semi-finals and final, which it might actually happen. And it will be take away from Lewandowski again, who, to be honest, deserves it after that. You know, he had that period of, like, I think it was the coronavirus season, as we'll call it. And then he didn't get it last year, did he? And Messi took it and said, oh, like, Lewandowski should have got it.
How did Messi get that last year? That shows you it's politics, bro.
Of course. So I'm praying that Lewandowski that gets it this year, even though Benzema's just obviously killing it and he's getting all the attention right now. So it's going to be a weird one, but we'll see. We'll move on from the Champions League and we'll do the Football League roundup. So we'll go over who's been promoted, who's been relegated from the Championship, League One and League Two, because we don't give enough time, to be fair, to the lower leagues of English football, and we should. So Scunthorpe United, who have been relegated for a while, are the first team to drop out of the Football League this year. They were joined by Oldham Athletic, where some fierce fan protests have been brewing on the pitch over the last few weeks. Very sad set of affairs, I think, when teams do drop out of the Football League into the dreaded National League. But there have been some success stories of teams bouncing back and being better. So, you know, it could look better for both those clubs. But I think history says that if you go down there, it's tough to get back out. At the other end of League Two, Exeter City and Forest Green Rovers make the step up to League One. They'll be joined by one of five teams still in the hunt for the last automatic play. So that should make soccer Saturday interesting on the weekend. Quick highlight on Forest Green. This is their first ever promotion to the third tier of English football. And they are considered one of the first, if not the first team to be a vegan and carbon neutral football club. So the players eat vegan food. I'm not sure if this is required by contract. The solar panels power the stadium. The pitch is organic and pesticide free. Yada, yada. We get it. It's cool. What do you think about this, Jim?
I was just thinking this might be a joint football team for me and Miss Campbell. I think she could get behind a team like this. Not that we'll be watching full games or anything, but something we could keep a little pin on social media or whatnot. I think she'd be well into that. I think that's pretty cool. No, as long as they don't contractually make that a thing, like an obligation, I would not be down with that at all. But if everyone's on the same vibe and they're on some zero carbon footprint shit as a club, I think that's basically a positive thing.
Yeah, and I think they don't sell meat at the games and stuff like that. So it'll only be sort of like vegan options. But I think fair play. It's a definitely a revolutionary way of running a football club. So good luck to them. League One, we know the final standings of. I have absolutely no idea why League One played their last league games well ahead of the Championship and a week ahead of League Two. Championship has still got, or they still had at least two games to play. We had a few midweek and last weekend, but League One finished early. Not really sure why. Crew Alexandra, Tommy Howe's team. Maybe we can ask him why the League One finished so early. They finished bottom, followed by AFC Wimbledon, Doncaster, and finally Gillingham, who made up the relegation places on goal difference. Doncaster probably being the big surprise there. They had finished in the playoffs 2 years ago, losing in the semi-final stage, and then were ninth last season. They will play fourth tier footy for their only second season out of 17. And the business end of League One, Wigan Athletic and Rotherham are back in the Championship after a year in League One. MK Dons narrowly missing out, but will join Sheffield Wednesday, Sunderland and Wickham in what is a proper stacked League One playoff picture. I wouldn't fancy picking either of those to go up. What do you reckon, Jim?
I was just thinking about Wigan Athletic, man. They were doing the business back in like 2006, playing the Premier League up until when? Like 2008, 2009, playing Chelsea. Do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know they'd fallen that far down the league tables, but I suppose there are other considerations other than quality of player and the support of the fans. We've spoke often about how clubs can be mismanaged, and I'm not even sure if that's the case with Wigan Athletic, but I was taken aback when you said they've been in League One just then. I remember playing on FIFA 07 with them through career mode for no particular reason. So I've got an affinity of them from back in the FIFA days. And we were watching, I think it was the Championship. It must have been. Was it Port Vale? But where are Port Vale? Are they in League One or the Championship?
No, they're definitely playing, not in the Championship. They're in League One or League Two, Port Vale.
They were playing the other day and I watched that at Stitch's house. And yeah, I can see why. Well, for me, I just thought, right, this is quite a steep drop-off in terms of standard of football. But then I was thinking, oh, it's wicked. These lads are earning like probably a couple of grand a week to do what they love. Regardless, they don't even need to play in the Champions League or whatever. It's like pretty feel-good factor all around. And the fans were loving it, like proper loving it. It just seemed like a more wholesome side division of football in general.
Shout out to Stitch. Getting some League Two football on, man. Fair play. I haven't watched a League One or League Two football game in a long, long time. Something that I should definitely try and get back into. But finally, the Championship, Fulham absolutely strolled to the title, scoring 100 goals as a team for the first time in league history, I believe. Alexander Mitrovic scoring 43, I think, goals now. With still a game left. Breaking every goal scoring record for the foreseeable future. I don't think anyone's going to get anywhere near that. Obviously, parachute payments work an absolute treat for Fulham. Another team where parachute payments are working is Bournemouth. They cemented their automatic place with a 1-0 victory over Steve Cooper's rejuvenated Forest midweek. So just to talk about the promotion, boys, you know, Fulham and Bournemouth, nobody's shocked, innit? Absolutely nobody's shocked. And who's got relegated from the Premier League? Norwich and Watford. What's going to happen next year? Fulham and Bournemouth probably going to get relegated. Norwich and Watford probably going to go up. So is this becoming a bit of a bit boring because it's been so predictable about which teams are going up?
Well, not if I was a Fulham fan or if I was a Norwich fan, I imagine there is more emotional investment in that revolving door between the Championship and the Premier League than there is for teams who are kind of middling in each division. I mean, pick your teams. There are a subset of teams that basically finish between 7th and 15th every year. And you could probably pick them out of a hat. I imagine that gets a little bit unfulfilling after a while, just in terms of competition and what you're playing for. Cup runs excluded, obviously. But yeah, I think it's probably exciting and a little bit depressing when they get relegated. But just to bring it back to Alexander Mitrovic, I watched his highlight from this season and last the other day, and he's been scoring absolute bangers. And he played in the Fulham team that was managed by Scott Parker that got relegated. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I think he was at Newcastle before that in the Premier League. So he has got Premier League pedigree, man. He's a good player. So I think, you know, if he goes up with, obviously he's going to go up with Fulham, I think he's probably going to stay there. But I think this time, should, you know, Fulham be bottom again by Christmas and by the time the January transfer window opens, I think he'll go maybe to a better club, either in Europe or somewhere else in the Premier League, where, you know, I think he deserves his chance, man. He deserves his chance at a big club.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. Is it that he's kind of, to use the combat sports metaphor, is he kind of caught between weight classes in that he's absolutely elite in the Championship and basically not that good in the Premier League?
No, that's a fucking great. I love that. I love that analogy. Because he literally is. He's caught between weight classes. And he's what, 27? So he's kind of like at what you'd call the peak striker age as well. I think he was. He was at Newcastle. They signed him. Fulham signed him for 8 million, did they? 8 million? No, 24 million. So they paid, they paid a fair whack for him. 24 million euros, that is. So they paid a fair whack for him. But honestly, man, I think he'd do a job at like one of the teams that perhaps are like, you know, pushing for the top to get into that sort of, maybe the European places in the Premier League. I think he'd do a good job there, man. Like, he's obviously excelling in the Championship. 43 goals and 7 assists in 43 appearances is incredible. 47% goal participation, only 1% more than Son Heung-min. So that shows you how good he's been and how many goals Fulham have scored and the chances they create. So I'd love to see him. I'd love to see him if you know, Fulham aren't doing so well. You never know. Fulham might surprise people and might come out and do really, really well in the Premier League. But yeah, let's go over the arse end of the Championship. So hapless Barnsley, you know, they were a really strange one. They finished in the playoffs last year. They've got these billionaire owners, apparently, but they couldn't make it work. They were relegated a few weeks ago. And they finished bottom, even when Derby and Reading were deducted huge amounts of points. I think Derby were minus 21 and Reading were minus 12. Peterborough joined aforementioned Derby in the depths of the third tier. And, you know, that is going to be sort of a really diabolical place to be next year. And Blues would have been there if it wasn't for the points deductions. And that is the God's honest truth. We got really, really lucky this year. We'll move on. Quick review of Europe. Real Madrid pissed La Liga. Bayern Munich made it 10 titles on the bounce, defying our 9 title bogeyman that we spoke about on the pod. Do you remember that? Who was it? Was it
Celtic and Rangers, man?
It was Celtic doing the 9, and it was also Juventus, wasn't it? They did 9 and they couldn't get the 10th.
Oh, yeah.
And it was Celtic that did 9 and couldn't get the 10th because Rangers pipped Celtic. And then I guess it was Inter Milan when Lukaku was there and Mancini, they pipped Juventus to their 10th. So they broke that curse. But swiftly into the Premier League, let's talk about your Arsenal. Winning by means that have become more synonymous to them losing by in recent years. And what I mean by this is scoring 2 goals from set pieces. I think one was direct. I think the Gabriel one was Gabriel? No, the Rob Holding one was direct from corner. And then Gabriel, I think, was recycled from a corner. But Rob Holding, Gabriel getting on the score sheet, Jared Bowen for West Ham. So what did you make of Arsenal? And they sort of bounced back from that those 3 losses where it was like, oh, yeah, old Arsenal are here, like, you know, poor finish to the season. And then they bounced back with 3 absolutely huge wins, man. So you must be buzzing.
Mate, I can't actually remember the last time Arsenal churned out successive results against teams of that quality at such a late stage in the season. And after that poor run you've just alluded to at that, how do you go from losing 3-0 to Palace, 2-1 to Brighton and 1-0 to Southampton to beating Chelsea 4-2, United 3-1 and West Ham 2-1 it defies everything I've come to learn about Arsenal over the past 15 or so years. They beat Chelsea and West Ham away as well, which is something you'd never really back Arsenal to do. Tottenham's draw with Brentford helped. Like, that upturned the race in terms of points gained, etc. But mainly, Arsenal have done it by actually showing bottle. The last time you could legitimately apply that term to an Arsenal team, I was still wearing Nike shocks and listening to the streets, mate. It's unbelievable. I know there's a few games to play and I don't want to get overly gassed. And I know that United are an absolute shambles at the minute. I've got no illusions about that. I know Chelsea have had a late season dip, which has surprised me, to be honest. But I still don't think you can undervalue those results. And the West Ham result, that's not even a low-key banana skin. They're a difficult team to beat. West Ham are a quality side and away as well. And as you mentioned, by means that you would never normally associate with Arsenal. I think Odegaard, Smith Rowe, even Elneny, they've all been class. That midfield has been the shining light for me. Martinelli, I would like to see him get a little bit more game time because I think he's very impactful. Ramsdale is manna from heaven, right? Nuno Tavares is a liability. So is Granit Xhaka. And even they both scored against United. Everyone's chipping in. Imagine if they get Gabriel Jesus next season. Him and two new fullbacks. And we're in business, man. We're talking top four.
And to be fair, Steady Eddie Nketiah, like, he's looked pretty good as well over the last few games. All right, he didn't get on the score sheet in that particular game. But he looks solid, man. Like, he's reminded me of Saka, the way he carries the ball. And he's really attacking, do you know what I mean? He's direct.
Saka, I've completely left out Saka there. The composure on that lad after the Euros last year as well. How many players would have crumbled? You've mentioned Liverpool's keeper from a couple of seasons ago. Career basically finished. He's a young kid. Do you know what I mean? How many kids would crumble under that pressure? He deserves all the credit in the world. He's always part of the move. Do you know what I mean? He's always in a pivotal position. Eddie Nketiah as well. I think he scored two against Chelsea. He was on his way out the door in the summer. Now they're like, nah, we'll keep hold of you, mate. Absolutely sweet. Everyone's coming to the forefront at the perfect time. I can't believe it, man.
Yeah, I think getting Tomiyasu back from injury as well has been a massive help because I think he's been pretty integral to, you know, that form that Arsenal was showing early on in the season. He was part of that. I'm not sure if he came back for the three games that they lost or how much game time he's had since. But he, for me, is turning into a really integral part of the way Arsenal play. And I think Arteta knows that as well because I was reading a lot about him coming back in and, you know, them wanting to get him back in, back from injury. 55% starting 11 rate, and that's, you know, considering he's been injured as well. I think over the last few games, so he came back for the United game.
Yeah, and he came on, yeah, and he was absolutely ripping it up the right flank. Ronaldo even had to put in a dirty little foul on him just to, like, buoy him up because his creative juices were flowing a little bit too strongly. He's just a sick player, man. And that's what I say. Like, two new fullbacks would be nice to have cover in those areas because when you've got Cedric and Nuno Tavares on, it's not good down those flanks, you know, at all. They are a liability. And regardless of their contributions in the United game, Granit Xhaka's a liability as well, for sure. He got a yellow card for kicking the ball away. But who does that? Impetuous. This is a big game against a team who are your direct rivals for the top four, which means a massive financial income for the club, massive elevation in terms of status for the club. You know, we've been finishing like top eight these last two seasons, man. Screw your fucking head on. But why are you kicking the ball away? He's only one slide tackle away from getting a red card at that point. It just so happened he scored a screamer, but 9 out of 10 times, that's not what happens with Xhaka, man. I'd love for him to just dip, I would.
Yeah, he's one of those players, and he's a loose cannon for sure. And I think Arsenal do probably need to recruit in that central midfield position in January if they want to get anywhere near to challenging for the title. They've obviously got a lot of work to do to get there. But I was just going to let Tommy ask you stats here. So Arsenal have only lost 4 games when he's been in the starting lineup. One to Man City, one to Liverpool, and one to Man United. So that's pretty good, man. They've lost 4 games when he hasn't been in the starting lineup. So fair play to him. He's obviously very impactful for Arsenal. We'll quickly gloss over the other two games that were kind of at the top in the sort of promotion chase, league winning chase. Obviously, you've got Man City that dominated Leeds 4-0. No surprises there, really. Leeds, who, to be honest, like 3 or 4 weeks ago, you weren't really talking about them as being involved in that sort of that relegation battle. But all of a sudden, because Burnley have picked up 3 wins on the trot, obviously Everton beat Chelsea 1-0 in that huge game that we're going to talk about in a sec. But Leeds have all of a sudden been thrusted back into this relegation battle, man. So what do you make of them? And do you think they're probably one of the favourites to take that sort of third after we know Watford now have been relegated, I believe? Have they? Or they're very, very close. Norwich have been confirmed relegation. I think Watford are basically confirmed. So there's one relegation place left. Who do you think is going to get it? Do you reckon it's going to be Burnley, Everton or Leeds?
You know, I don't think it's a surprise that Leeds are down in that position. They were getting hammered earlier in the season, that 5-1 at Old Trafford. They're getting hammered now. When Bielsa left, it was questions galore. It was injuries. It was overtraining. It was the high-pressing system losing steam, wasn't it? And it just so happens that a lot of teams, including Everton, have started underperforming around the same time. I don't think they've been far away from a relegation scrap this whole time. That is the exact opposite of what you want when you're competing with Burnley, who have been in this situation week in, week out, year in, year out for the last decade. And we've said it before, man. They've got rid of Sean Dyche. Who the hell knows why? They know how to get out of a relegation scrap. They know how to do it, man. And they're picking up points at the perfect time in the season. If there was a gun to my head, I would say Leeds are going down. That's what I think.
No, I think that's fair. And obviously, Everton has still got their own fate in their hands. They've got that game in hand, which would leapfrog. I think Burnley and Leeds. No, it wouldn't. They wouldn't leapfrog Burnley unless they beat the team 5-0. So I'm not sure who that game in hand is to. I think they've got 5 games left, Everton. And, it's not easy reading from still. They've got to play Leicester away on Sunday.
Leicester aren't the undeniable prospect that they would have otherwise
been. They were maybe at the start of the season, yeah.
Yeah, or even at the start of the season, they had maybe a 3-game run where they're like, fucking hell, Jamie Vardy's smashing it. And they're looking intense. Since then, individual players aside, Kasper Schmeichel included, and is it Tienemans in the middle of the park?
But he's not been getting much game, and he's a player that I've absolutely spoke volumes about over the past few months, maybe even longer than that, maybe a year. I've been saying that I think he's going to be a player that's going to play at the top level at some point. But Brendan Rodgers, what I saw when I look at Leicester's lineup, is he's playing a lot of games on the bench, man. He's starting on the bench a lot, so he hasn't really been used as much. I think he's preferred Dewsbury Hall a lot this season. And they've also got Abubakar Samari as well. So I'm not really sure. Tommy Howes is just joining us now, by the way. So he can sort of help us with the last few games. But how's it going, Tommy? Also, I wanted to ask you about Crew as well. What's happened there, mate?
About Crew, man.
Also, yeah, that's what we were talking about earlier. Why did League One finish their games like 2 weeks before the other football leagues? Like they're done and dusted, aren't they? They've played all their 46 games now, whereas League Two still got to get a game week left and Championship still got a game week left. I don't know why they finished early.
No, maybe they're just international break, because the Championship sometimes have a bit of time off around international break, or is it never a thing?
No, I always thought that Championship, League One, League Two, they always finish on that 12 o'clock, midday soccer Saturday, isn't it? And that's all I've known. I have no idea why this year League One's finished. Literally, I have no idea.
Lost interest in that.
I bet you did with your team being rock bottom. All right, but we'll move on to the NFL chat. Obviously, we've just kind of rounded up Everton's next 5 fixtures, Jim. We were looking at 5 fixtures and we were saying about Everton, you know, they looked like maybe 3-4 weeks ago that their fixture list looked absolutely terrible reading. We mentioned it on the podcast, but now their last 5 games, they look like they could probably win 3 of the last 5. So it's looking like, as you say, I think if a gun was stuck to your head, you'd probably say Leeds, man, because Burnley won the last 3. They're on the ascendancy. Leeds just been battered by Man City. So yeah, I'd probably make them favourites to get relegated.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And I'm unsure because I've took a toilet break. Have we introduced our esteemed guests yet?
Don't think we have formally, so we will, man. So we have Tommy Howes on the podcast for the first time. Good to see you, mate. You're going to go over some NFL stuff, aren't you? Some of the trades that have happened postseason, and also some info on the NFL draft, which wasn't a blockbuster this year because of the lack of quarterbacks, if I'm right in saying that.
Yeah, only one quarterback was taken in the first round, and that was Kenny Pickett, who went to the Steelers at number 20. But apart from that, no other quarterbacks, no running backs or tight ends in the first round. Just a lot of wide receivers and defensive players.
Just a quick question, Tommy. In terms of your interest in NFL, when did you get into that? Like, apart from my mate.
Question, to be fair.
Yeah, sorry.
Because why the fuck? And it, like, no, to be fair, like 7 years ago, I had no interest in the NFL at all. I used to play fantasy football, Premier League, and that was it. And then a mate from uni, just as we were about to leave, he asked if I wanted to join his NFL fantasy football league. And I thought it was a good opportunity to sort of stay in contact with him and other people. So 7 years ago, I started that. I was really bad at first. But over those course of 7 years, I've got to know more and more about the sport. And just started to really enjoy it. Because I think the fantasy football element like brings a lot of excitement to it. There's a program called Red Zone, which is effectively whenever a team gets into sort of the final 25 yards of the pitch, so they're getting close to scoring a touchdown. And most of the time, because of the format of fantasy football, you've got some sort of stake in those games as well. So if a touchdown's scored, you're either happy or pissed off.
That's nice, to be fair, because that's the exact opposite route I would expect someone to take into watching a sport. So you've gone literally pen and paper or screen. You've gone stats first. I thought, okay, this is going to lend into my interest in the sport. Well, Bissett introduces a new metric every week, really, as to like statistical analysis. What was the one you brought up today? Like players' contributions towards goals. And I was thinking that first it was the XP, and now it's this new one. And the staticization of sports, it's almost a thing in itself in terms of looking at numbers and analyzing it. And that. Yeah, Moneyball. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it's fascinating.
Brentford have employed quite a lot of statistical analysis, from what I understand, which has allowed them to kind of buy key players that have some metric that's been sort of given, that's allowed them to move up into the Premier League.
So, to be fair, that's fascinating, man. So, sorry to interrupt the NFL draft analysis, but I was actually wondering how I've got so many friends that are so deep into NFL. And I've tried to watch it, man. I've genuinely tried. I've adopted a team. The Falcons are my team for whatever reason. And I have actually tried, and I don't get it, man. I don't get it. Nah, but
I understand that completely, to be fair. But I think that fantasy element where I've got a stake in the game and a bit of money, like a few bets, bit of money in the leagues that I'm in, like not loads, but it just sort of helps to form a bit of excitement. And Sunday evening, a few beers, bit of shouting at the TV, fucking love it, mate.
So what you're trying to say is you're a degenerate gambler and a degenerate alcoholic, and that's why you got into it. Now, but I was the same man with the Bears. Like when I was going through the teams, I was like, I want to get into it. The best way to do that is be invested in it. So pick a team.
And the Bears are pretty woeful at the moment, aren't they?
And they were woeful. Probably,
they've got to be one of the worst teams to watch as well, because they're defensively good, even though they've just traded away Khalil Mack to the Chargers, right? But they're offensively really bad as well. So you know it's going to be a low-scoring affair.
So it was a bit like Blues, really, wasn't it? Like, do you know what I mean? I found a team that was kind of aligning itself with Birmingham City. Do you know what I mean? Absolute hopeless guys. Maybe were once okay. Like obviously the 1985 Bears were absolutely brilliant. Considered one of the best defensive teams like in history. But I just kind of chose them because basically Warwickshire Bears, isn't it? That was my That was my kind of thinking. I was like, Warwickshire Bears make sense. I was into cricket at the time. And I thought, all right, let's go for the Bears, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, my adopted team are the Bills. And I mean, there's not much reasoning behind that, but the fans look fun when they're like jumping through tables and stuff. And I feel like I could get on with them quite well.
Oh, don't talk about jumping through tables, man. We're going to get on the wrestling conversation.
We'll stay away from the wrestling convo, but I thought it was your interest in Bill Clinton and how he acted, which is why you've adopted the Bills as your team, mate. Completely stand-up individual.
And a model citizen. Model citizen, Bill. But let's move on to the NFL stuff that happened prior to the draft. So what were the key trades that happened so far? You just alluded to one, obviously, Khalil Mack going to the Chargers. There was also Davante Adams going to the Raiders and Tyreek Hill moving from KC to Miami. Which one would you say is the sort of like most effective one? Which team has made the trade that's really going to like take them from a team that had virtually no chance of winning a Super Bowl this year to a team that, all right, now we're considering them like a legit contender?
I'd say that would be the Denver Broncos getting Russell Wilson. I think they've got two really good wide receivers in Cortland Sutton. And what's the other lad's name? The rookie is in his third year now, I think. That's bad. But I mean, Russell Wilson is a Super Bowl winning quarterback. He's got the caliber that will allow him to go into a setup that, provided that they've got the pieces around him, they'll be challenging. And I think it's a tough league, tough division that they're in. But I think Russell Wilson has got that caliber and that sort of game management that will allow the Denver Broncos to be a serious contender next year. With Davante Adams, he's pairing back up with his college quarterback, Derek Carr. And I think that had a big amount to do with his decision to go back there, or to go there, to rejoin with him. And then Tyreek Hill, people are questioning whether Tua is going to have enough to really be able to maximise the potential there. If Tua takes a step up, he's got some brilliant weapons. He's got Jalen Waddle and then Tyreek Hill, the speedster. So I think of all of those big trades, I think the Denver Broncos have got the most potential to go on and win a Super Bowl. But they're all big moves. And that's what I think has been interesting about this offseason. There've been some massive moves. Like in the 7 years that I've been aware of the sport, there's been nothing like this.
Yeah, I think it was probably Jerry Jeudy. Was that the guy that you
were trying to think of?
But it's interesting you say that. You mentioned that about Davante Adams going to a quarterback that you played with at college, because we saw how effective that can be with the Bengals, didn't we? And the link up between
Jamar Chase
and Burrow in it. So obviously they were both at, was it LSU that they were both at?
My college team understanding, well, knowledge is pretty bad.
I think it might be LSU that they were together there. Anyway, we know that they were together in college, and then now they're back together in the NFL. So I think that makes a big difference when it comes to sort of getting that link up, because the margins are so fine in the NFL, isn't it? Like you've only got fractions of a second.
It doesn't always work out, because Patrick Mahomes was a massive proponent of the Chiefs drafting Clyde Edwards-Helaire. And I think they moved up in the draft quite high to get him, and he was taken higher than anyone expected. And that hasn't really worked out for them yet. I mean, that could change, but it's not guaranteed that if you have the college chemistry, it is going to work out. But I think it should be a good indicator, as you say, Chase and Burrow. I mean, Chase has come on and had a rookie season like no other.
And Casey, maybe our Casey, by letting Tyreek Hill go, and I'm sure they've got a massive compensation for him in terms of draft picks, but are they making a little bit more of a pivot to maybe introducing more of the run game? Because obviously they've got Clyde Edwards-Helaire there. So maybe they're thinking, right, we've been a team that's been predominantly like pass heavy over the last couple of seasons, and they've been very effective at doing that. Are they now perhaps trying to maybe pivot to having a little bit more of a balanced offense?
Potentially. But I guess this is one of the narratives that led into the NFL draft. It was how are Green Bay going to replace Davante Adams? And how are Kansas City going to replace Tyreek Hill? Are they going to try and move up in the draft? They're both pretty successful teams, so they had quite low draft picks. And there was a lot of wide receivers available that everyone that was scouting them were saying were really good coming into this. And and neither of those teams did end up making any significant moves. I think with Kansas City, you've got Travis Kelce there, and he's a dominant tight end that, you know what I mean, he's just one of the best players in the league. He's got that blocking ability, so he's great at the line of scrimmage, but then he can break away and make massive runs and score touchdowns. They've brought in Markell MVS from Green Bay.
Valdez-Scantling.
He's a bit more of an explosive route runner, but I mean, he's not Tyreek Hill.
Yeah, and they got rid of Byron Pringle as well. Byron Pringle went to Chicago Bears. So Bears obviously looking to, to get a couple of wide receivers in, but obviously they're not going to be challenged for the Super Bowl. So let me put you on the spot. So obviously you mentioned how effective Russell Wilson's going to be, in Denver. That's going to improve their chance to win a Super Bowl. But who would you make your favorite? And, you know, if we had to put a gun to your head, which team would you be picking to win the Super Bowl this year?
It's got to be Buffalo.
Mate.
Buffalo
soldier. Now, to be fair, like they've been pretty close, haven't they, last couple of years? I think they were beat by KC 2 years ago. And this year they had that heartbreaker, didn't they? Who was that against this year? Because KC got beat by
Kansas City again.
Bengals.
It was Kansas City back-to-back years. It was Kansas City.
Oh, yeah. It was in the championship game. And then it was the divisional game the year before. Yeah. So there you go,
Kansas
man.
Kansas City are like the bogey team recently for the Bills. But, I mean, the Dolphins and the Jets, who are in the same division as Buffalo, have both made significant moves this offseason. So I don't think that division is going to be anywhere near as sort of cut and dry as it was the last couple of years. I mean, it's not like the Buffalo Bills ran away with it last two seasons, because you've always got the Patriots there and Bill Belichick and his ability to sort of just get the job done with whatever players he's got. So I think it's a really tough division. But you're right, Buffalo have got close, but they've never won a Super Bowl. I think they got to the Super Bowl three times in a row, maybe in the 80s, but never won it. So there's a real monkey on the back of the club, the franchise, that's it, which is tough. I mean, fantasy football, I got to the final of my fantasy football league four times and didn't win it until last year. And I tell you, if I hadn't won it last year, I'd have been slitting my throat, man. Because it was
Mate, that's it. We're comparing elite level sports, man. Like, you know, fantasy football comparing it to NFL, man. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, obviously the elite level sports, the fantasy football manager, man. You're gonna get there.
But no, yeah, it's rough, man. It is. I mean, I think because it's such a difficult thing to get to a Super Bowl final, to not make it across the line and win it. It must be a very difficult thing for people to come back, players to come back from. Obviously, I'm not comparing my fantasy football championship.
Yeah, you are.
With elite level. Perish the thought, Tommy. I didn't think you were doing that at all. But there are parallels there, albeit at different stakes. But yeah. Imagine the discomfort you felt at doing that a couple of years in a row versus... it's unbelievable, man.
Yeah.
All right, so anything else from you, Jim? Any other questions?
I would just like to say, what a fantastic addition Tommy Attis has been. And I think this is going to signal, much to my chagrin, the return of major NFL coverage on the Ball Chats podcast. I mean, Tommy, you're welcome back anytime, because I think that was absolutely tremendous. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
We'll have to get you on. We'll have to get you on every couple of weeks, mate, to do a little NFL review or something. Do you know what I mean? Do a little recap during the season. Because obviously it's a short season, and it's only like, what, 17 regular game weeks, and then you've got the sort of like 4 weeks or whatever it is that the playoffs span over. But yeah, man, that'd be good if we get a little NFL review, because me and Jim, we're watching that many fucking sports along with our actual lives. It's like very, very difficult to keep up on it. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah,
it'd be good to have another voice on.
An absolute pleasure, man. It was sick. Like, that sounded fucking sick, man. Pulling out 80s references at your arsehole, like, for the Bills and that. That was fucking wicked, man. Well done.
Safe. Nice one. Nice one, lads.
People who watch the NFL, I feel like that'd be good content for them, man. Definitely. Sure.
Yeah, and I think there's quite a few that probably are into it, man. So, yeah, great to have Tommy Howes on. Definitely going to get him back on in the foreseeable. Try and, yeah, I'd say like maybe bi-weekly. We get him on or once a month just to sort of do a 15, 20-minute review of what's been going on in the NFL. I think he'll be great at doing that. All right, so we'll move on to the five things that you might have missed if you were pissed. I'm not sure who I want to keep. I'm not sure how.
That was another thing that I put in. I just thought that would really fucking annoy him.
Yeah, and you were absolutely bang on. Like, but number one, Everton's doggo mascot. Did you see this? And their guerrilla tactics to try and put Chelsea's team off in the hotel by setting off fireworks outside the hotel and whatnot. But let's stick on the doggo. So they paraded this dog outside Goodison Park, and it was like they were about to sacrifice him to get a win. Like, the dog looked absolutely terrified. I think I sent the video in the group, but I'm not really sure how this came about or why he's been designated the mascot, but you can guarantee he's going to be there for the next home game.
Yeah, it did work, didn't it? It absolutely worked.
Here's what it is, mate.
But anyone who has a problem with the occult, I will direct them to this evidence. Right here, this literally that's the kind of thing that would make a person in a precarious mental position believe in the Almighty. So, all fair play to Everton, because that is some, we say shithousery a lot in a lot of different ways, but that is some like demonic druid level King Arthur Merlin type shit right there. So, fair play.
And talk about the occult and demons. Tom Brady, who has now been playing in the NFL, the Spice Melange. In the NFL longer than one of his... He's been playing in the NFL... All right. Game face. He's been playing in the NFL longer than one of his newly drafted teammates has been alive. So this is scary, superhuman stuff. Logan Hall, a defensive end drafted by the Tampa Bay Bucs as the 33rd overall pick, was born six days after Brady was drafted as the 199th pick in the 2000 draft. Absolutely incredible stuff. And it just shows you that the draft, although it might look like you're picking the best players, you can still get the GOAT at 200 picks down.
I was just about to say, I don't know what's more unbelievable, the fact that that age disparity is what it is, or that Tom Brady was 199th in the draft. He is, the comparisons we've made them, they're obvious. It's Ronaldo, Michael Jordan, Tom Brady, those people who eclipse expectations at the apex of professional sport. I don't even know that much about him. And I absolutely love Tom Brady and everything he represents. And it doesn't surprise me. I mean, how many 18, 19-year-olds are just about to break into the Premier League now? I'll tell you what, forget that. Kylian Mbappe had posters of Ronaldo on his wall when he was a kid. And now he's up there basically emulating his celebrations and that. It's outstanding. You can't say enough good about Tom Brady. And the age disparity is a testament to his greatness.
And that sporting longevity, that is a testament to greatness as well, isn't it? Just being able to stick around there and he's still performing at elite levels, man. That is what, when you talk about greatest of all time, because that term gets bandied around far too much for me. But when you're talking about greatest of all time, that's what you're talking about. Players that can play at the elite level for two decades. And that's kind of what Brady's done. And, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo, you can put in the same breath, near enough, 15 years of eliteness. So there you go. They're the true GOATs. Number three, Coventry United ladies team, who were deducted 10 points in January, secured FAWC, so their league safety, in the 7th minute of added time with an absolute peach of a free kick. And this is something I shared on the Ball Chat Sports Twitter page. Molly Green smashed the ball home from a good 35 yards against Watford to secure the win, which condemned Watford to relegation. And as I just alluded to, you can check this out on the Twitter page. If you can bear the shrieking as the goal goes in, like literally like, there's a banshee somewhere absolutely like howling. And that's not being derogatory or anything, but there is someone shrieking.
I imagine the chest thumping roars of men are absolutely what's the best word to say it? Can you imagine how many women roll their eyes and just fuck off into the next room when their men are watching TV and they're going, ah, can you believe it? Can you fucking, like, that's just their equivalent version of it. Because women's sports, and especially women's football lately, you think about the, is it El Clasico? That was one of the most attended games and most, like, televised games in recent memory. It's happening, and we're being exposed more and more to the, to basically, like, what women are like in that kind of sporting context. It's definitely alien, but I think it's basically a good thing. Bear in mind, I haven't listened to it, and if it shatters my eardrum, I'll definitely be cursing them out.
It 100% will, and I was tempted to sort of, like, put it on the sound bites of this episode, but I will not do that. Also, shout out to Newcastle women, who I think are playing in the fourth tier of women's football, and they had like 20,000 people in St. James's Park the other night. That is what you're talking about in when you're talking about the evolution of the women's game and how popular it is becoming. I dare say that in maybe a decade, they'll be close to levels that we're getting in the sort of like championship, you know, in terms of their Premier League.
How often have we spoken about it? It's the difference between men and women. It's not really their physical abilities, or although there are discrepancies in that area, it's just that the reason women's football, a large reason that women's football isn't as popular as men's, is because it haven't received like the same amount of coverage. And like, if you expose people to a product and it's exciting and it's something people can empathize with, they'll get behind it and spend money. And I think that's happened a lot with female sports people over the last 5 years or so. And I think the companies are getting behind it. Listen, you could always trust businesses to try and make money. And it just so happens that female sports is starting to attract a lot of money. It's a feel-good thing. I don't give a shit about that men versus women type thing, really. We've had our discussions about trans athletes and that in the past, but that's kind of a different issue. I think it's wicked. I honestly do think it's like a wicked thing that they're like achieving on this level. Fair play to him, man.
Fully agreed. All right, number four, Luis Diaz can win a personal sextuple, which means that he can win six medals for the trophies that his teams have accomplished this year. After guiding Liverpool to the Champions League final, obviously he can win the quadruple with Liverpool. After they've already got one in the bag, they can still pip Man City to the title, along with the FA Cup if they beat Chelsea, and also now the Champions League if they beat Real Madrid. And also, if Porto, his team that he was with in January, win the league and cup double, he could, I would say, I doubt there's any other player that's won six trophy medals in 1 year. I can't think of any other player that's ever done that.
I was thinking about this the other day when I was watching, I think it was Diaz against Benfica, actually. And I was wondering, would he get a Champions League winner's medal? I didn't know where the cutoff point was in the season. So this is answering a lot of questions that just jumped into my head for no reason. When is that? Do you know when the cutoff point is? Or
I know the Premier League. I don't know, but I know for sure that in the past it has been 10 appearances to win a Premier League medal. So I think he will get that because I think he's already on 8 or 9. I'm not sure what it is in the Portuguese leagues, and I'm not sure what it is in the Champions League. I think in the Champions League, it might just be one appearance, if I'm not mistaken.
There's a load of bookie players for loads of teams who have got Champions League medals, like Wes Brown back in the day for Man United, and that the Gazer didn't even play, basically like one substitute appearance and he's got a Champions League medal.
And like Jimmy Traore, who I think won the Champions League with Liverpool, and he was another one, and he went on to play for Blues.
Here's another classic, Cinema Pong goal. Do you remember that, Gazer?
Oof, pulling out some names now. Yeah, but as you say, there is a few bookie players that like managed to get hold of medals. It's a bit dirty, really. I bet these are the guys as well that hang this as the centerpiece in the house as well, innit? Like you get like Mo Salah and like these elite players like Ronaldo, he probably just throws them in, like not in the bin, but he'll definitely just have like a drawer somewhere for him. Whereas you go Cinema Pong goal, he's going to have his fucking hung above on the mantelpiece like.
Nah, Ronaldo's got the showpiece. He's probably got a gallery like dedicated to his achievements.
Probably adorned around the statue of himself, innit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, it's Luis Diaz isn't one of those players, is he? You can see the way he's hit the ground running at Liverpool and this version of Liverpool, which have been ruthless for time. He's slotted into there like he belonged, that aggressive style of play. That inventiveness, that daring to do little things on the pitch where you might want to be conservative. I think he deserves the medal if they win the final against Madrid, which is not a certified thing because look at what Madrid have done against Man City in the last two legs in the semi-finals.
Yeah, and number five, Joe Hart plays for Celtic. And that is something I absolutely missed. I literally had forgot about his existence, but I was looking at the Old Firm derby that finished 1-1 between them and Rangers. And he was in there. Also, I was just very shocked to see him there. And I was also wondering whether people actually care about Old Firm derbies anymore, because I remember the reason I was into Celtic Rangers, or the reason that I'd be watching it, is because like we had a big Irish community coming from Birmingham, and a lot of people that would be invested sort of for whatever reason, usually down to sort of like either religion or your parents, you know, follow a certain team because of this or that. But generally, it comes down to religion, doesn't it? And then
see what, this a Bissett spit it out. It's plastic paddies in Birmingham. No, there's no prods in Birmingham, is there? There's no Protestant people. It's just Catholics all around. I know what you're saying. And in my teenage and early 20s years, I didn't really give a shit about it either. But for some reason, and I don't know what that reason is, over the last 5 years, I've actually started to like care about Irish stuff in general. That doesn't mean I keep an eye on every Old Firm derby that's going on. But when I seen this question in the script, I was like, what do you mean? My back was up straight away, even though I've got no empirical data to thrust upon you. But yeah, I would say that in a league that I can safely say is basically like maybe League One's a drop too far, but I'd probably back Fulham on their current form to smash either of them. But maybe Rangers, they've had those good run of results.
And they're in the semi-final of the Europa League, playing against RB Leipzig very, very shortly. So, you know, I think those two teams aside, the rest of the league is, I would say, yeah, championship standard for sure.
That's poor. It's poor. It's a poor league. The top for a top level league in your country, it's poor, but you know.
But what a fall from grace for Joe Hart, I would say. sounds a bit harsh, but like, I remember when he was probably considered like, you know, one of the best goalkeepers in the world, man. He was England's number one. He was Man City's number one. Like he literally had the world at his feet. And now he's been sort of knocking about different clubs. He's playing in the Scottish League, which, you know, nobody's going to consider it as being like a top European league. It's just certainly not. And I'm not sure how old he is now. Maybe in his sort of like early 30s. Just shows you, man. Like things can sort of turn on its head very, very quickly in football.
Well, we won't hark on this for too long, but when do you think that fall off came? Because he won the Premier League with that 2011 squad. Aguero, he was in that team. And they were like, you know, going back and forth. Maybe he made like a couple of high-level errors, but I don't remember him being on like a highlight reel of shit keepers or anything like that. I remember him moving to Roma and thinking, oh, that's a bit of a weird one. You know, when did that happen for Joe Hart? I don't know.
I'll tell you exactly when it happened, mate. I think, and I could be wrong, as I often am, that it might have been when Guardiola first came. I think he wanted a keeper that was better at distributing the ball with his feet. And I don't think Joe Hart was very adept at doing that. So I think when he came in what was it, 2015, 2016, Guardiola, I think Joe Hart, would have still been there. And maybe he wanted a keeper that was a little bit better at that. So I think as a transition, I think he started. And also, he was making a few mistakes. So I think Pantilimon was there at the time. I think the Romanian keeper, really like huge keeper. And I think he was getting in ahead of Joe Hart. I think he took his first team place, unless I'm mistaken. And then, so that transition to Pep wanting sort of more ball-playing goalkeepers. I think Willy Caballero was there at some point. I can't think of any other keepers that were in there during that period. And then obviously they fell on Edison, who's now the number one. They got Zach Steffen there as well, who's kind of proven that he's not very good at, you know, the sort of build from the back either, because he's made some howlers. But I think it was all about trying to get a keeper that was better at sort of building from the back, had good distribution. So I think that's perhaps why he sort of like fell out of favour.
Well, I would disagree with your assertion that he's fallen 1,000 leagues from heaven. But to be fair, one thing the Scottish League offers is prestige within its own kind of sphere, like Rangers versus Celtic. That's a different you know, cultural thing. But yeah, again, I don't want to harp too much on that because I'm pretty sure we're running quite long on time at the minute.
Oh yeah, this is going to be a bumper episode. So yeah, so that'll be it for the five things you might have missed. And we will now get into the featured fights with a review of last weekend's action. And unfortunately this week, we will not be getting on with the feature fights because I forgot to record the second time that we did this with Jim. So Jim will be looking to do a sort of featured fights review on Sunday morning to cover the UFC and cover the boxing, all the big stuff that's happening in combat sports over the weekend. Hopefully he'll be doing that with Tino, so there'll be someone there that can go through it with him. So it'll be kind of like a live reviews that I think we're going to put on the Instagram. So be sure to check that out. As always, if you haven't already, check us out on Instagram, check us out on Twitter. Thanks a lot for listening, and we will see you next week.